Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israel continues its airstrike campaign on Lebanon in what Israel says are ongoing operations against Hezbollah. This as Hezbollah launches more rocket attacks into Israel. VOA's Arash Arbasadi has the story.
Israeli airstrikes on Sunday crash into southern Beirut. Israel says the attacks are part of its ongoing campaign against Iran-backed terror group Hezbollah. Meanwhile, a residential building in Israel has its side blown out following an attack of more than 185 rockets throughout the country launched by Hezbollah in Lebanon. The militant group began its most recent campaign of launching attacks into Israel following the Hamas terror attacks against Israel on October 7, 2023. Hezbollah said it did so in solidarity with Hamas. Pressure continues climbing for a ceasefire deal between the nations. And the European Union pledged more than $200 million in support of Lebanese armed forces while seeking an end to the war. As cross-border fire continues, Lebanon's caretaker prime minister accused Israel of sending a direct and bloody message rejecting all efforts to reach a ceasefire. The all-out war between Israel and Lebanon erupted in September. About 90 Israeli soldiers and nearly 50 civilians have died so far. And according to Lebanese officials, more than 3,500 people there died, with about 1.2 million people, nearly a quarter of its population, displaced. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News.
This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday denounced the killing of a rabbi in the United Arab Emirates as a heinous anti-Semitic terrorist act. Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo has more.
The body of Rabbi Zvi Kogan was found as tensions in the region continue to rise, with reports of Israeli strikes killing dozens in Lebanon and Gaza over the weekend. Rabbi Kogan managed a kosher supermarket in Dubai, where he went missing on Thursday. He's seen in front of the store in social media video, filmed 2 days before he disappeared. He also worked for an Orthodox Jewish group in the UAE. Netanyahu said on Sunday his country would, quote, act with all means to bring justice to the murderers. Kogan's body was found in the Emirati city of Al Ain, which borders Oman, though it is not clear if he was killed there or elsewhere.
I found it in Al Ain, but
that's according to a former Israeli Druze politician who spoke to Reuters. Emirati and Israeli authorities have not said who was involved in the killing or what the motive might have been.
Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. Nations from around the world reached an agreement on how rich countries can support poor countries in the face of climate change in the early hours Sunday at the UN's COP29 climate conference. But many officials and activists say they are unsatisfied, calling it a far from perfect arrangement. AP correspondent Melina Walling has more from Baku, Azerbaijan.
Rich countries have agreed to pool together at least $300 billion a year by 2035. It's not near the full amount of $1.3 trillion that developing countries were asking for and that experts say was needed. But some delegations said this deal is headed in the right direction, with hopes that more money flows in the future. Activists and experts expressed concern that the agreement lets rich countries off the hook for their role in the climate disasters that are hurting communities around the world. And members of some developing countries said that the number doesn't begin to match their need, and they expressed anger and disappointment at the deal.
AP correspondent Melina Walling. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky on Sunday called on Ukraine's Western partners to concentrate their efforts on helping provide an air defense system able to protect people after Ukraine air defense units shot down 50 of 73 drones launched overnight. Zelensky said Ukraine was working with its allies to find a response to Russia's use of a new medium-range ballistic missile last week. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
airstrike hits Beirut. COP29 wraps up, but is everyone happy with the results?
We are extremely, extremely disappointed.
And President-elect Donald Trump is still saying he likes tariffs. World economies are nervous.
Coming to the U.S. market is going to be difficult. I'm not optimistic about U.S. trade with Africa if we're talking about increasing tariff.
Today is Monday, November 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Steve Karish. Beginning today in the Middle East, the Israeli military warned on social media that it planned to target Hezbollah facilities in southern Beirut. This before strikes demolished two apartment blocks on Sunday evening. Afterwards, the IDF said it had hit command centers deliberately embedded between civilian buildings. This follows one of Israel's deadliest and most powerful strikes on the center of Beirut on Saturday, killing at least 84 people. Later, Hezbollah fired about 250 rockets and other projectiles into Israel, wounding 7 people in one of their heaviest barrages in months. Meanwhile, negotiators press on with ceasefire efforts to halt the all-out war to no avail. Countries at the COP29 climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, adopted a $300 billion a year financial target on Sunday to help poorer nations cope with impacts of climate change. But is it enough? Diane To of Reuters has the story.
We are extremely, extremely disappointed.
Developing nations slammed a global climate financing deal as woefully insufficient as delegates at the COP29 summit in Baku adopted a $300 billion annual target on Sunday to help them deal with impacts of climate change.
I regret to say that this document is nothing more than an optical illusion. This, in our opinion, will not address the enormity of the challenge we all face.
The agreement was clinched in overtime at the two-week conference in Azerbaijan's capital. It commits rich countries to providing $300 billion a year by 2035 in climate financing. That's a boost from the previous deal of $100 billion annually by 2020. That earlier goal was met 2 years late in 2022 and expires next year. United Nations climate chief Simon Steele hailed the agreement as one that would keep the clean energy boom growing and urged developed nations to keep their promises this time.
It has been a difficult journey, but we've delivered a deal. This new finance goal is an insurance policy for humanity amid worsening climate impacts hitting every country. But like any insurance policy, it only works if premiums are paid in full and on time.
The summit cut to the heart of the debate over the financial responsibility of industrialized countries to compensate others for worsening damage from climate change after their historic use of fossil fuels caused the bulk of greenhouse gas emissions. It also laid bare divisions between developing nations reeling from costs of storms, floods and droughts, and wealthy governments facing tight domestic budgets and surging geopolitical tensions.
And yet we do feel that the result of today is actually exceptionally important. We are living in a time of truly challenging geopolitics, and we should simply not have the illusion that it will soon get better.
Negotiations had been due to finish on Friday, but ran into overtime as representatives from nearly 200 countries struggled to reach consensus. Some developing countries and island nations walked out briefly in frustration on Saturday. The final deal also failed to set out detailed steps for how countries will act on last year's climate summit pledge to transition away from fossil fuels and triple renewable energy capacity this decade.
That's Diane To of Reuters reporting for us. And as we've heard, developing countries left COP29 unhappy with the final deal that gives them $300 billion, or only 25% of the $1.2 trillion they say they need. For some context on all this, I'm joined by Rachel Cletus. She's Policy Director of Climate and Energy Programs at the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Yeah, we're at a very crucial moment in the climate crisis where we need to accelerate a global transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And at the same time, we've already locked in some pretty fearsome climate impacts. Just as COP was unfolding, the Philippines had been hit by its fourth typhoon in 2 weeks. We've had terrible hurricanes here in the United States, Helene and Milton most recently. Spain has seen devastating floods. So this was the sobering backdrop. And nations need money to help them protect their people and their economies from these ravages of climate change, which are primarily the responsibility of richer nations and their heat-trapping emissions, which are a majority of the emissions in the atmosphere. So that's what was on the table here. This was a climate finance COP. And lower-income nations need money to accelerate the transition, cut their emissions, as well as adapt to climate change. $300 billion is a pittance.
So given that reality and given the economic and the political reality in many parts of the world, is it better to spend money, to spend limited money, on mitigating the effects of climate change or on combating the causes, on helping decrease those harmful emissions?
It's not either or, it's both. And the reality is we cannot adapt to runaway climate change. So we've got to do everything we can to cut heat-trapping emissions and limit further worsening of climate change. To do that, we have to turn down fossil fuels and transition to clean energy as quickly as possible. But at the same time, we're just a little over 1.2 degrees Celsius increase in global average temperatures above pre-industrial levels. And we're already seeing some pretty stark impacts. We've locked in, unfortunately, a lot of costly, deadly impacts. So we have to, at the same time, prepare for them. It's both and always.
Understood. Both things have to happen. But with limited money, how do you allocate those resources?
I question that premise. There is money. And right now, unfortunately, too much of that money is flowing to fossil fuels, including subsidizing fossil fuels around the world. This is the moment where we have to shift that money to clean energy, which is not just going to help us address climate change. It's also going to help us address the huge public health burden from fossil fuels. Millions of people around the world dying from just particulate matter pollution from fossil fuels. There is money. It just needs to be put to the right purpose.
One of the big issues overwhelming geopolitics these days is the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump. Was that spoken about in Baku?
Well, it definitely cast a pall over the proceedings in the early days at Baku, because there is a clear sense that the incoming Trump administration is an anti-science administration that has called climate change a hoax. They're going to take a wrecking ball to domestic and international climate policies, very likely to exit the Paris Agreement, unfortunately. So that is definitely sobering. Nevertheless, the Biden administration is still the U.S. government and was representing the U.S. at these talks. And it was very unfortunate because they played a big part in lowballing the climate finance outcome that was secured finally at this COP.
Rachel Cletus is the Director of Policy for Climate and Energy Programs at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Cletus, thanks so much for your analysis today. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Somalia's government says 24 people are dead after two boats capsized in the Indian Ocean off Madagascar's coast. Somalia's foreign minister said 46 people were rescued. Most of the passengers were young Somalis, and their intended destination remains unclear, though many young Somalis embark on dangerous journeys in search of better opportunities abroad. Forecasters in the U.S. have warned of another round of winter weather that could complicate travel leading up to Thanksgiving. California is bracing for more snow and rain while still grappling with some flooding and small landslides from a previous storm. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a law granting debt forgiveness to new army recruits who enlist to fight in Ukraine. The measure, whose final version appeared on a government website Saturday, underscores Russia's need for military personnel in the nearly three-year-old war. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Looking now at American politics and the incoming presidential administration, countries around the world are bracing for economic upheaval as U.S. President-elect Donald Trump threatens massive tariffs, especially on China. The uncertainty has left governments and businesses struggling with how to respond. VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul, South Korea.
During his first term, Donald Trump imposed sweeping tariffs on China, shaking the global economy. Ahead of his return, Trump is vowing even more drastic measures. 10% tariffs on all imports to the U.S. and a staggering 60% on goods from China. While China hasn't commented directly on Trump's threats, it has warned against further trade tensions. Mao Ning is the Chinese Foreign Affairs Ministry spokesperson. She says, we don't answer hypothetical questions, but reiterates there's no winner in a trade war, nor will the world benefit from it. Any Trump tariffs could especially hurt economies that depend on exports. But an expanded U.S.-China trade war could also create opportunities. Many countries have benefited as production shifts away from China to avoid tariffs. Thailand's commerce minister recently told VOA's Thai service his country has seen an influx of U.S. companies relocating factories from China. He says we should be able to weather this. He actually sees these problems as benefits for Thailand. He believes we can be an investment destination for every country. That approach comes with risks, though. Many countries that gained from trade moving out of China now heavily rely on exporting to the United States, leaving them even more vulnerable to any blanket Trump tariffs or efforts to crack down on rerouted goods. The concerns stretch beyond the biggest U.S. trading partners. In Africa, where trade with the U.S. is already limited, higher tariffs could make access even harder, one analyst told VOA's Africa 54.
If we talk about manufacturing, if we're talking about production of produce, pineapples, and coming to the U.S. market, it's going to be difficult. I'm not optimistic about U.S. trade with Africa if we're talking about increasing tariffs.
Much of the uncertainty stems from Trump's unpredictability. During his first term, he often used the prospect of tariffs as a bargaining tool before eventually striking individual trade deals, says analyst Jayant Menon.
Trump is not a protectionist, I think, right? He's a deal maker. That's what he likes to present himself as, you know, the art of the deal and all that. So he likes free trade agreements that he has a role in.
Menon says countries targeted by Trump could push for new trade agreements instead of tit-for-tat tariff escalations that could harm themselves and the global economy. Not all of Trump's proposals point toward increased protectionism. He's also suggested rolling back subsidies for U.S.-made electric vehicles, subsidies put in place by the Biden administration. Again, Menon.
He's already called them, you know, silly. In a podcast with Joe Rogan. So he's probably going to roll them back. And that's a positive, right, in terms of the distortions that affect the global economy.
Both risks and opportunities as the world figures out how to respond to the return of an unpredictable U.S. president. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
It's often said that necessity is the mother of invention. And in Ukraine, Russia's invasion in 2022 meant that the Ukrainian government needed to find a new way to do things. From digital passports to apps that announce air alerts or enable conscripts to update their information for the draft register, Ukraine is now a world leader in the drive to digitize government services. From Kyiv, Lacia Bakalets has more.
In only 6 years, Ukraine has jumped from 102nd to 5th place among 193 countries globally in the Online Services Index category of the United Nations e-government survey. Valeria Tkach is a deputy director of the Department for Electronic Services Development at the Ministry of Digital Transformation of Ukraine.
Ukraine cannot evaluate itself. Only experts from other countries can. We are very happy to take fifth place. For many years in a row, Ukraine took 100th, 80th places.
Valeria Tkach credits Ukraine's drive to digitize government services on a mobile application and portal called DIA, which means action in Ukrainian.
Ukrainians just need to have the DIA app on their smartphone, and all the documents are available online, so they can present them to any state agency.
Ukrainians can register a business or even get married online through DIA.
With the war, internally displaced persons can register in DIA and receive financial assistance. Also, there is a program for damaged property restoration due to hostilities.
The war also prompted the development of apps like Air Alarm. Valentin Kritsenko is a chief marketing officer at Ajax Systems.
The app notifies in real time about the possible danger of missiles, chemical or nuclear weapons.
Ajax Systems, a security system company, is one of the app developers. Before that, residents relied on street sirens activated from hidden locations after receiving alerts from the Air Force.
A duty officer activated street alarms mechanically, relatively speaking, by pushing the button. So we have developed a program where a person on duty can activate the alarm for the app too.
There are about 24 million app downloads, Rosenko says.
In the world, there is no similar solution for so many people. Before the full-scale invasion, the most famous app with air alarm and shelter map was in Israel, but the scale is different.
New apps also helped the Ukrainian army streamline much of its paperwork. Katerina Chernohorenko is a deputy minister of defense of Ukraine for digital development.
Reserve Plus app is the most popular product of the Ministry of Defense. The purpose is simple, to make all the services of our recruiting centers and enlistment offices online.
Men of conscription age can now use an app to update their data as required by the law.
Also, we recently launched the opportunity to choose vacancies in the app and voluntarily join the ranks of all defense forces.
Chernohorenko says all the data are well protected. She says the war has created conditions that have made the development of new digital products more urgent, a challenge Ukraine has had to face all while being under fire. Lesya Bakalets, VOA News, Kyiv.
Residents in Kabul, Afghanistan are struggling with severe water shortages, often waiting hours for drinking water. The United Nations cautions that urbanization and climate change could deplete the city's groundwater within the next 5 to 6 years. VOA's Afghan service has this report narrated for us by Behzad Hamdard.
Residents of Kabul's Beni Hisar neighborhood spend hours in line to fetch water, as most wells in the region have dried up in recent years. One of the few remaining functional wells located in Haji Mamur's home draws people from miles away seeking access to water.
We let people get water from the well we dug inside our house. You see these barrels. When they are filled, other people come for water. Regarding water, we have a lot of problems.
The United Nations warned last month that Kabul's groundwater could be depleted by 2030 due to climate change and rapid urbanization. The UN called for immediate action. Experts say that the water shortage in Kabul could be alleviated by restricting the use of underground water for industrial and agricultural purposes. But authorities are looking at other solutions, says water and environment issues expert Said Abdulbasit Rahmani.
The important thing is that transfer water to Kabul, particularly from the Panjshir River. This should be the priority for the authorities, as people in Kabul cannot wait for long-term projects. This is a solution in the short run.
A multi-million dollar project to deliver Panjshir River water to Kabul is ready to start construction, Taliban authorities say. Matiullah Abid is a member in the Ministry of Energy and Water.
In this regard, God willing, it will address the problems because it is a single project that would provide drinking water to 2 million people.
But for now, some residents of Beni Hasar are thinking of moving to another part of the city where they could access water. Abdul Wase is one of them.
We will be forced to move from this village. We were already displaced, and we will move to another place. We came here from Logar province, and we will go somewhere else because of water.
But the UN estimates that nearly 80% of the people in Afghanistan lack access to clean drinking water, so Wase doesn't have many options. For Afghan Service, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Guatemalan journalist Kimé de León wanted to amplify the voices of those affected by environmental issues and human rights, so she helped found a media outlet that focuses on marginalized and indigenous communities. Now she's being recognized for that work with an International Press Freedom Award. Christina Caicedo-Smith has the story.
Protecting Guatemala's diverse landscape and the indigenous communities who live and work there is an issue Kimé de León focuses on daily. To better amplify the voices of those communities, she helped co-found the media outlet Prensa Comunitaria, or Community Press. Kimé de León is the co-founder of Prensa Comunitaria.
We wanted to know and report about what was happening with civil society and with affected communities, the arrival of extractive companies and the impact this was having on the daily life.
In their coverage of human rights and environmental issues caused by mining and extraction, De León and her team report from their perspective of those affected, speaking with community leaders, women coalitions, students, and indigenous groups. The aim, she says, is to report on issues no one else is covering.
Community violence, political violence, evictions, or even what people are proposing as an alternative model of life. All of this is not in the media. And I also think that feminist journalism and the conversation about women's human rights were not in the digital field.
That work has earned De León an International Press Freedom Award, presented by the Committee to Protect Journalists. For De León, the award is the result of more than 10 years of hard work by her and her team.
It is something very nice and related to the importance of having the right to do journalism and to be recognized as such.
But her accolades and accomplishments come with challenges and threats. Under the previous Guatemalan presidential administration, De León was harassed via social media and threatened with possible criminal charges.
If you report about complex issues that have to do with extractivism, with drug trafficking, with corruption, with power groups, with sexual and reproductive rights, all these issues still pose a risk, especially if you are at the local or community level.
Even though the Prensa Comunitaria team has had challenges, De León says they will still act as a voice to communities forgotten, excluded, or marginalized in Guatemala. Cristina Caicedo-Smith, VOA News.
And finally today, the story of a small, unusual church in Madrid. It's called the Vaticano, which is a mix of the words for duck and the Vatican in Spanish. And it's where comedian Leo Bassi organizes masses every weekend.
Yo quiero honorar el patito y hago una capilla y hago misas. Al principio.
He says, I wanted to honor the rubber duckies, so I thought about doing it in some small chapel and start doing mass. At the beginning, I didn't know which direction it was going to go, and maybe this thing lasted a month. But 12 years later, it is growing, growing, and growing, with such a deep message about valuing the little things. Bassi started this initiative in 2012 to venerate, as he says, the small things. And thanks to social media, his idea became so popular that despite celebrating three masses on Sunday, dozens of people were clamoring to get in. During the one-hour event, Bassi mixes humor with current affairs while quacking several times to entertain the audience. And that is going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Parrish.